which would mean that the probability that any two genomes today share a particular ancestor at this time is small, there being many possible ancestors in each generation. But the other possibility was that the ancestral human population consisted of multiple, highly divergent groups instead of a single, freely mixing group, and hence the lineages ancestral to present-day people were isolated in separate populations at this time. This pattern could be reflecting the same mixture event that Patterson had highlighted through his study of mutation frequencies. The reconstructed time corresponds to a period when there is skeletal evidence of archaic human forms overlapping with modern human forms in Africa. For example, the Homo naledi skeletons recently discovered in a cave in South Africa had relatively modern human bodies, but brains much smaller than those of modern humans, and date to between 340,000 and 230,000 years ago. There was also a third line of evidence for archaic mixture. A commonly held view is that the San hunter-gatherers of southern Africa largely derived from a lineage that branched off the one leading to all other present-day modern human lineages before they separated from one another. If so, the San would be expected to share mutations at exactly the same rate with all non-southern Africans. But Pontus Skoglund in my laboratory showed that the San share more mutations with eastern and central African hunter-gatherers than they do with West African populations like the Yoruba of Nigeria. This could be explained if the West African populations harbor more ancestry from one of the early splitting populations than is the case for non-African populations. Perhaps all present-day humans are a mixture of two highly divergent ancestral groups, with the largest proportion in West Africans, but all populations inheriting DNA from both. These results suggest the possibility that major mixture in Africa occurred in the time well before around 50,000 years ago, when modern human behavior burst into full flower in the archaeological record. This mixture wasn't a minor event, such as the approximately 2% Neanderthal admixture in non-Africans or the ghost archaic ancestry in Africans found by Wall and Hammer. Because this mixture was closer to 50-50, it is not even clear which one of the source populations should properly be considered archaic and which modern. Perhaps neither was modern, or neither was archaic. Perhaps the mixture itself was essential to forging modern humans, bringing together biological traits from the two mixing populations, and combining them in new ways that were advantageous to the newly formed populations. How agriculture threw a veil over Africa's past. How can we begin to learn what happened in Africa after the ancestral population of modern humans was forged, and also after the ancestors of present-day non-Africans spread out of Africa and the Near East, beginning around 50,000 years ago? There is a lot of information to work with, as African genome sequences are typically about a third more diverse than non-African ones. Human diversity in Africa is extraordinary, not only within, but also across populations, as some pairs of African populations have been isolated for up to four times longer than any pairs of populations outside the continent, as reflected by the fact that for some pairs of populations, like San hunter-gatherers from southern Africa, and Yoruba from West Africa, the minimum density of mutations separating their genomes is that much greater than that for any pair of genomes outside Africa. But learning about Africans' deep past from today's populations is extremely challenging, because while much of the ancient variation still exists in people living today, it is all mixed up. The most recent mixing of populations occurred in the last few thousand years, due to at least four great expansions, all of which are associated with the spread of language groups, and most of which have been driven by the spread of agriculturalists. These expansions have thrown a veil over the African past, moving populations thousands of kilometers from their places of origin, where they've displaced, or mixed with populations that were widespread before. In this respect, the study of African populations is no different from the study of Eurasian ones, which have also turned over in the last several thousand years. The agriculturalist expansion that had the greatest impact on Africa is the one associated with people who speak languages of the Bantu family. Archaeological studies have documented how, beginning around 4,000 years ago, a new culture spread out of the region at the border of Nigeria and Cameroon in West Central Africa. People from this culture lived at the boundary of the forest and expanding savanna, and developed a highly productive set of crops that was capable of supporting dense populations. By about 2,500 years ago, they had spread as far as Lake Victoria in eastern Africa and mastered iron toolmaking technology. And by around 1,700 years ago, they had reached southern Africa. The consequence of this expansion is that the great majority of people in eastern, central, and southern Africa speak Bantu languages, which are most diverse today in present-day Cameroon, consistent with the theory that proto-Bantu languages originated there and were spread by the culture that also expanded from there around 4,000 years ago. Bantu languages are a subset of the larger Niger-Kordofanian family spanning most of the languages of West Africa, which likely explains why today the frequencies of mutations in groups in Nigeria and in Zambia are more similar than the frequencies of mutations in Germany and Italy, despite the former two countries being separated by a far greater geographic distance. Ultra-sensitive genetic methods, which can detect shared relatives of pairs of individuals in the past few thousand years, have now made it possible to learn something about the geographic path of the Bantu expansion. The genetic variation in Bantu speakers in East Africa is more closely related to the genetic variation in Malawi to the south of the Central African rainforests than it is to genetic variation in Cameroon. This suggests that the initial Bantu expansion was largely to the south, and that the movement to East Africa was a later expansion from a southern staging ground. This contrasts with the theory of a direct eastward movement from Cameroon, a theory that had been plausible prior to the genetic data. Another agricultural expansion that had a profound impact is the one that spread Nilo-Saharan languages, spoken by groups from Mali to Tanzania. Many Nilo-Saharan speakers are cattle herders, and a common view is that the Nilo-Saharan expansion was driven by the spread of farming and herding in Africa's dry Sahel region during the expansion of the Sahara Desert over the last 5,000 years. One important branch of Nilo-Saharan is the Nilotic languages, which are mostly spoken by cattle herders along the Nile River and in East Africa, including the Maasai and Dinka. The genetic data make it clear that Nilotic-speaking herders were not always socially disadvantaged relative to farmers in the frontier regions where they encountered each other. For example, the Luo group of western Kenya, to which former U.S. President Barack Obama's father belonged, are a primarily farming people who speak a Nilotic language. But George Ayodo, a Luo scientist from Kenya, who spent time in my laboratory, found that the mutation frequencies in the Luo are much more similar to those of the majority of Bantu speakers, likely reflecting a history in which a Bantu-speaking group in East Africa adopted a Nilo-Saharan language from its high-status neighbors. The African language expansion, whose origin is most unclear, is the one associated with Afro-Asiatic languages. They are most diverse in present-day Ethiopia, which throws weight behind the theory that northeastern Africa was the homeland of the original speakers of these languages. But the Afro-Asiatic language family also contains a branch localized to the Near East that includes Arabic, Hebrew, and ancient Akkadian. It has been hypothesized on this basis that the spread of Afro-Asiatic languages, or at least some branches of them, could have been related to the spread of Near Eastern agriculture, which introduced barley and wheat and other Near Eastern crops into Northeast Africa up to 7,000 years ago. New insights are already emerging from ancient DNA, which makes it possible to document ancient migrations between the Near East and North Africa that could have spread languages, culture, and crops. In 2016 and 2017, my laboratory published two papers showing that a shared feature of many East African groups, including ones that do not speak Afro-Asiatic languages, is that they harbor substantial ancestry from people related to farmers who lived in the Near East around 10,000 years ago. Our work also found strong evidence for a second wave of West Eurasian-related admixture, this time with a contribution from Iranian-related farmers, as might be expected from a spread from the Near East in the Bronze Age, and showed that this ancestry is widespread in present-day people from Somalia and Ethiopia, who speak Afro-Asiatic languages in the Cushitic subfamily. So the genetic data provide evidence for at least two major waves of north-to-south population movement in the period when Afro-Asiatic languages were spreading and diversifying, and no evidence of south-to-north migration. There is little, if any, sub-Saharan African-related ancestry in ancient Near Easterners or Egyptians prior to medieval times. Genes do not determine what language a person speaks, and so genetic data cannot by themselves determine how languages spread, and thus cannot provide definitive evidence in favor of one theory or another about whether the ultimate homeland of Afro-Asiatic languages was sub-Saharan Africa, North Africa, Arabia, or the Near East. But there is no question that the genetic data increased the plausibility of a Near Eastern agriculturalist source for at least some Afro-Asiatic languages, and the genetic findings raise the question of what languages were spoken by these north-to-south migrants. The fourth great agriculturalist expansion in Africa is the one associated with the Khoi-Kwadi languages of southern Africa. Like the two language groups spoken by hunter-gatherer groups in the south of Africa, Kha and Du, Khoi-Kwadi languages are characterized by click sounds. Based on shared words for herding, it has been hypothesized that Khoi-Kwadi languages were brought from East Africa by cattle herders who came to southern Africa after 1,800 years ago, and who may also have picked up click sounds from local populations. The genetic data support the hypothesis of a major genetic contribution by East Africans to Khoi-Kwadi-speaking populations today. In 2012, Joseph Pickerel in my laboratory showed that Khoi-Kwadi speakers share a disproportionate amount of their ancestry with Ethiopians, compared to the Kha and the Du, as might be expected from a migration from the north. The size of East African-derived DNA segments in some of the Khoi-Kwadi-speaking populations is what would be expected from mixture 18 to 900 years ago with a ghost herder population, consistent with the arrival of herders around this time, and a delay before the mixture with local populations was complete. Within the segments matching East Africans, Pickerel found even smaller segments that matched Near Easterners more than they did any other populations, and that had lengths expected for an average mixture date of around 3,000 years ago. That is the average date of mixture between people of West Eurasian-related ancestry and sub-Saharan ancestry and many groups in Ethiopia. So this finding provides further support for the hypothesis of an East African source. Ancient DNA has now verified this hypothesis. In 2017, Pontus Skoglund analyzed ancient DNA from the approximately 3,100-year-old remains of an infant girl from Tanzania in equatorial East Africa, and an approximately 1,200-year-old sample from the western Cape region of South Africa, both buried among artifacts and animal bones that identified them as being from herder populations. The Tanzanian girl was a member of the ghost-herding population that Pickerel and I had predicted, a group that derived most of its ancestry from ancient East African hunter-gatherers, and the remaining part from an ancient West Eurasian-related population. This population almost certainly played a major role in spreading cattle herding from the Near East and North Africa across sub-Saharan Africa. Our ancient DNA evidence from the southern African herder also strongly supported this idea, showing that this individual derived about one-third of her ancestry from the pastoralist population, of which the Tanzanian girl was a part, and her remaining ancestry from local groups related to present-day San hunter-gatherers. The mixture of ancestries in the 1,200-year-old southern African herder was very similar to that in present-day Khoi-Kwadi speakers, many of whom are herders, supporting the theory that early Khoi-Kwadi languages, herding, and this type of East African ancestry, all spread to southern Africa through a movement of people. The landscape of human biological and cultural diversity in Africa today dominated as it is by the effects of the agricultural expansions of the last few thousand years, is extraordinary. But it is also distracting, if one's interest is in understanding the big picture of what happened. A trap that researchers of African genetics, archaeology, and linguistics repeatedly fall into is celebrating Africa's present-day diversity, epitomized by a slide showing the faces of people from across the continent who look very different from each other, that many of us use when presenting on Africa. It is tempting to think that in order to comprehend deep time in Africa, we need to be able to hold all of that diversity in our heads and explain all of it at once. But most of the present-day population structure of Africa is shaped by the agricultural expansions of the past few thousand years. And so focusing on describing Africa's mesmerizing diversity, paradoxically, does the project of understanding the big picture of humans in Africa a disservice. Just as much as focusing on the common origins of all modern humans in Africa does Africa a disservice. We need to stop focusing on describing the veil, and instead rip it away. And for this, we need ancient DNA. Reconstructing Africa's forager past. Who lived in Africa before the expansion of food producers? The people who so profoundly transformed the human landscape of the continent? Answering this question is extraordinarily difficult, based on patterns of present-day variation. In the introduction to this book, I described how Luca Kabili Sforza made a bet in 1960 that it would be possible to reconstruct the deep history of human populations based entirely on patterns of genetic variation in present-day groups. However, he lost his bet, as ancient DNA has revealed that there has been so much migration and population extinction that in most instances, it is very difficult, even with sophisticated statistical methods, to recover the details of ancient demographic events from the traces left behind in the DNA of present-day people. The breakthrough that is making it possible to get beyond this impasse will not be surprising to the reader. It is genome-wide ancient DNA, which can be co-analyzed with data from groups that have been genetically and culturally isolated compared to their neighbors, among them the Pygmies of Central Africa, the San hunter-gatherers of the southern tip of Africa, and the Hadza of Tanzania, whose languages with clicks are very different from the languages of the Bantu who surround them, and whose genetic ancestry is highly distinctive as well. Some of these populations harbor genetic lineages that are highly divergent from their neighbors. We can compare data from these ancient samples to probe events that occurred deeper in time than those that can be accessed only by analyzing the DNA of present-day populations. Well-preserved ancient DNA has until recently been hard to find in most parts of Africa because of the hot climate, which accelerates chemical reactions that degrade DNA. But in 2015, the ancient DNA revolution finally arrived in Africa because of improvements in the efficiency of DNA extraction techniques and a better understanding of which bones yielded the most DNA. The first genome-wide ancient DNA data from Africa came from a 4,500-year-old skeleton found in a highland cave in Ethiopia. This ancient individual was much more closely related to one group living in Ethiopia today, the Ari, than to many others. Today, there is an intricate caste system that shapes the lives of many people within Ethiopia, with elaborate rules preventing marriage between groups with different traditional roles. The Ari include three subgroups: the cultivators, blacksmiths, and potters, who are socially and genetically differentiated from one another and from non-Ari groups. Since the Ari have a distinctive genetic affinity to the 4,500-year-old ancient highland individual compared to other Ethiopian groups, it is clear that there were strong local barriers to gene exchange and homogenization within the region of present-day Ethiopia that persisted for at least 4,500 years. This is the best example of strong endogamy that I know of, even more ancient than the evidence of endogamy in India, that so far is only documented as going back a couple of thousand years. Ancient DNA keeps surprising us. In 2017, Pontus Skoglund in my laboratory analyzed 16 individuals from Africa, foragers and herders from South Africa who lived between about 2100 and 1200 years ago. Foragers from Malawi in southern Africa who lived between about 8100 and 2500 years ago, and foragers, farmers, and herders from Tanzania and Kenya who lived between about 3100 and 400 years ago. While these individuals are very recent compared to some of the oldest Eurasian ancient DNA, they nevertheless provide insights into African population structure before the arrival of the food producers who transformed much of Africa's human geography. A great surprise that emerged from our ancient DNA analysis was that there was evidence of a ghost population dominating the eastern seaboard of sub-Saharan Africa that appears to have been largely displaced by the expansion of agriculturalists. This population, which we called the East African foragers, contributed all of the ancestry of two ancient hunter-gatherer genomes in our dataset from Ethiopia and Kenya, as well as essentially all of the ancestry of the present-day Hadza of Tanzania, who today number fewer than 1,000. We also found that the East African foragers were more closely related to non-Africans today than they were to any other groups in sub-Saharan Africa. The close relationship to non-Africans suggests that the ancestors of the East African foragers may have been the population in which the Middle to later Stone Age transition occurred, propelling expansions outside of Africa, and possibly within Africa, too, after around 50,000 years ago. So the population that became the East African foragers had a pivotal role in our history. The East African foragers were not a homogeneous population. This is evident from the fact that our data include at least three distinct East African forager groups within Africa. One spanning the ancient Ethiopian and ancient Kenyan, a second contributing large fractions of the ancestry of the ancient foragers from the Zanzibar archipelago and Malawi, and a third represented in the present-day Hadza. Based on the sparse data we had, we were not able to determine the date when these groups separated from one another. But given the extended geographic span and the antiquity of human occupation in this region, it would not be surprising if some of the differences among these groups dated back tens of thousands of years. There is precedent for such separations within forager populations in Africa. In 2012, my laboratory and another showed that a group that I think of as the South African foragers, a lineage that is as divergent from the East African foragers as any present-day human population, contained within it two highly divergent lineages that separated from each other at least 20,000 years ago. East Africa is at least as rich a human habitat as Southern Africa, and it would not be surprising if separations among foragers in East Africa were at least as old. The second surprise was our discovery that some of our ancient African forager population samples shared ancestry from both South African forager lineages and East African forager lineages. Today, South African forager lineages are essentially entirely restricted to southernmost Africa, where they form an important part of the ancestry of nearly all of the populations that use languages with clicks in them, and where they contribute almost all the ancestry of present-day San foragers, as well as the ancient forager genomes we generated from southern Africa. But our ancient samples show that the term South African forager may be misleading about where the ancestral population of this group arose. Two approximately 1,400-year-old individuals from Zanzibar and Pemba Islands off the coast of Tanzania, an island chain that separated from the mainland approximately 10,000 years ago as sea levels rose, and thus plausibly harbors isolated descendants of a forager population that lived in East Africa around that time, were a mixture of approximately one-third South African forager-related ancestry and the remainder East African forager ancestry. A series of seven samples from three different archaeological sites in Malawi, in South Central Africa, which we dated to between about 8100 and 2500 years ago, were part of a homogeneous population that harbored about two-thirds South African forager-related ancestry, and the remainder East African forager ancestry. So South African forager ancestry was in the past distributed over a much broader swath of the continent, making it hard to know where this ancient population originated. Ancient DNA is teaching us that the history of modern Africa has its roots in ancient population separations and mixtures, even before the arrival of agriculture. Thus, the human story in Africa is complex at all levels and at all time depths, as might be expected from the continent's huge size, its varied landscape, and the antiquity of the presence of our species there. The ancient DNA revolution is only just getting a toehold in Africa. In the coming years, Africa will be fully included in the ancient DNA revolution, and data will arrive from remains, from more locations, and from deeper times. These data will surely transform and clarify our view of what happened in the deep African past. What's next for understanding the African story? Some of the most striking examples of the complexity of human population structure in Africa are the patterns of natural selection on the continent. People of West African ancestry today have a high rate of sickle cell disease, conferred by a mutation that changes the blood protein hemoglobin, the molecule that more than any other is responsible for ferrying oxygen around the body. This mutation has risen to substantial frequency under the pressure of natural selection in several places in Africa. In far West Africa, for example, Senegal, in West Central Africa, for example, Nigeria, and in Central Africa, whence the mutation spread to Eastern Africa and Southern Africa via the migrations associated with the Bantu expansion. The reason this mutation has risen to such a high frequency in each of these populations is that if a person carries one copy of mutation from either of his or her parents, it protects against the infectious disease malaria. Malaria is so dangerous that the protection provided to the approximately 20% of the population who carry one copy of the sickle cell mutation is balanced, in evolutionary terms, with the cost that the approximately 1% of the population has to pay in carrying two copies of the mutation and suffering from sickle cell disease, which kills in childhood without treatment. Strikingly, the mutation has arisen independently in each of three locations in Africa, which we know from the fact that the sequences on which it resides are all different. From a naive perspective, this seems surprising, as one would think that a mutation like this would be so advantageous to the people who carry it that once it arose, it would spread around the vast malaria zone of Africa, propelled by a tailwind of natural selection, if there was even a small rate of interbreeding among neighbors. A similar pattern is seen for the mutations in the lactase gene that confer an ability to digest cow's milk into adulthood. The genetic basis for lactase persistence is completely different in North Africans and in the Fulani of West Africa than it is in the Maasai of Sudan and Kenya, who carry different mutations, albeit in the same gene. As Peter Ralph and Graham Koop have shown, the multiple origins in Africa of sickle cell mutations and of mutations that allow people to digest cow's milk imply that the rate of migration among these populations, even in parts of sub-Saharan Africa less than a couple of thousand kilometers from each other, has been extraordinarily low since the need for these mutations arose. As a result, the most efficient way for evolutionary forces to spread beneficial mutations has often been to invent mutations anew, rather than to import them from other populations. The limited migration rates between some regions of Africa over the last few thousand years has resulted in what Ralph and Koop have described as a tessellated pattern of population structure in Africa. Tessellation is a mathematical term for a landscape of tiles, regions of genetic homogeneity demarcated by sharp boundaries, that is expected to form when the process of homogenization due to gene exchanges among neighbors competes with the process of generating new advantageous variations in each region. The size of the regions where the same sickle cell mutation or same lactase persistence mutation prevails reflects the rate of gene exchange among neighboring populations in Africa over the last thousands of years. Our understanding of African population history is still in its early stages, But it is already clear that the story is complicated, with separations within major lineages such as East African foragers and South African foragers dating back deep in time, and layers of mixture beyond the most recent ones that have arisen due to the spread of agriculture. Eventually, by obtaining many more samples of ancient DNA from Africa, we will be able to comprehend the range of human variation in Africa in the last tens of thousands of years and make meaningful reconstructions of population structure. What we can already be sure of is that in Africa, as in every region that has yielded ancient DNA, the model of an evolutionary tree, in which today's populations have remained unchanged and separate since branching from a central trunk, is dead. And that instead, the truth has involved great cycles of population separation and mixture. What we can be sure of, too, is that in Africa, as in every world region that has yielded ancient DNA, the data will disprove many commonly held assumptions. The implications of this complexity for society and for the way we need to rethink who we are is the theme of Part 3 of this book. Part 3. The Disruptive Genome. 10. The Genomics of Inequality. The Great Mixing. The American melting pot began to swirl almost as soon as Christopher Columbus arrived in 1492. European colonists, their African slaves, and the indigenous Americans were from populations whose ancestors had been isolated from each other for tens of thousands of years. Within a few years of meeting, they began mixing, founding new populations that today number in the hundreds of millions. Martin Cortes, El Mestizo, belonged to one of the first of those populations. He was born within 4 years of the start of the 1519 military campaign in which his father, Hernan Cortes, led just 500 soldiers to overthrow the Aztec Empire that dominated Mexico. His mother, La Malinche, was one of 20 female captives given over to the Spanish after a battle, and she first served as an interpreter, before becoming the mistress of Hernan Cortes. The Spanish quickly invented a term for the people of combined European and Native American ancestry who emerged from unions like this. Mestizo comes from the Spanish word mestizaje, which in English means miscegenation, the mixing of different racial types. To maintain their status in the social hierarchy, the Spanish and Portuguese set up a casta system in which people of entirely European ancestry, especially those born in Europe, had the highest status, while people who had even some non-European ancestry had lower status. This system collapsed under the demographic inevitability of admixture. Within a few centuries, people of entirely European ancestry were either an extreme minority or gone, and it was no longer feasible to limit power to those with entirely European ancestry. Following the independence movements of the 19th and early 20th centuries, mixed ancestry became a source of pride in South and Central America. In Mexico, it defines national identity. Migration of Africans to the Americas after 1492 occurred on a similar scale as migration of Europeans. All told, an estimated 12 million enslaved Africans were forced to make the journey, jammed into the holds of ships before being sold at auction. Slave traders from Spain, Portugal, France, Britain, and the United States made great fortunes by satisfying the colonialists' need for manual labor. African slaves worked in the silver mines of Peru and Mexico, and raised crops such as sugarcane, and eventually tobacco and cotton. Africans were less affected by old world diseases than Native Americans, and easier to exploit than indigenous people, as they were far from home and scattered among a population that did not speak their languages. Deprived of their cultural points of reference, slaves had little ability to organize or resist. Most were sold in South America or the Caribbean, where they were often worked to death. Around 5 to 10% were brought to what became the United States. Following the first recorded sale of slaves by Portuguese traders in 1526, the rate of importation into the New World increased, plateauing at around $75,000 per year, until the transatlantic slave trade was outlawed, in the British colonies in 1807, in the United States in 1808, and in Brazil in 1850. Today, there are hundreds of millions of people in the Americas with African ancestry, the largest numbers in Brazil, the Caribbean, and the United States. The mixing of three highly divergent populations in the Americas, Europeans, indigenous people, and sub-Saharan Africans, that began almost 500 years ago continues to this day. Even in the United States, where European Americans are still in the majority, African Americans and Latinos comprise around a third of the population. Nearly all individuals from these mixed populations derive large stretches of their genomes from ancestors who lived on different continents fewer than 20 generations ago. A small percentage of European Americans have large stretches of African or Native American DNA as well, the legacy of people who successfully passed themselves off into the white majority. A 1973 science fiction novel, Piers Anthony's Race Against Time, envisions a future in which the mixing of populations initiated by European colonialism reaches its inevitable conclusion, and by the year 2300, nearly all humans belong to a standard population. In that year, only 6 unmixed people are left. 1 pair of purebred Caucasians, 1 pair of purebred Africans, and 1 pair of purebred Chinese. These purebreds are being raised in human zoos by foster parents, and are being groomed to breed with the only remaining individual of similar ancestry to sustain humanity's diversity, a diversity that is viewed by the standard population as a resource of irreplaceable biological value on the verge of being lost. The premise of the novel is that the centuries after 1492 were a uniquely homogenizing time in the history of our species, a period of unprecedented mixing of previously separated populations, enabled by transoceanic travel, which brought together groups whose ancestors had not been in contact with one another for tens or hundreds of thousands of years. But this premise is mistaken. The genome revolution has shown that we are not living in particularly special times when viewed from the perspective of the great sweep of the human past. Mixtures of highly divergent groups have happened time and again, homogenizing populations just as divergent from one another as Europeans, Africans, and Native Americans. And in many of these great admixtures, a central theme has been the coupling of men with social power in one population and women from the other. Founding Fathers. Not long after the Constitutional Convention of 1787, the man who would become the United States' third president, Thomas Jefferson, began a sexual relationship with his slave, Sally Hemings. Jefferson owned a large plantation in the state of Virginia, where some 40% of the population was enslaved. Sally Hemings was an African-American slave with 3 European grandparents, but her mother's mother was a slave of African descent, and under Virginia law, the status of a slave was maternally inherited. Jefferson and Hemings had 6 children together. The Jefferson-Hemings relationship has been disputed by some who have suggested that Jefferson, who is America's greatest Enlightenment thinker and the author of the U.S. Declaration of Independence, would not have maintained an illegitimate family. However, a genetic study published in 1998 revealed a Y chromosome match between the male line descendants of Esten Hemings Jefferson, the youngest son of Sally Hemings, and the male line descendants of Jefferson's paternal uncle. The genetic findings could in theory be explained if a male relative of Jefferson was the father rather than Jefferson himself, but there is no historical evidence for this possibility. And there is a credible 19th century account of the Hemings-Jefferson relationship from Madison Hemings, another son of Hemings. A study by the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation in 2000 concluded that, with high probability, the story was true. According to the account of Madison Hemings, his mother had a chance at freedom because she joined Jefferson in France, where slavery was illegal. But she agreed to return as a slave to the United States with Jefferson under the condition that their children would eventually be set free. Hemings was 30 years younger than Jefferson, and in France, where she began her relationship with him between the ages of 14 and 16, she was dependent on him. She was also the half-sister of Jefferson's wife, Martha Randolph, who had died of complications of childbirth several years earlier, and whose father had a secret relationship with the mother of Sally Hemings. Historians have attempted to quantify how widespread families like these were in the United States. Mixed ancestry unions were often unrecorded, and when they were, children were categorized in different ways by different states. Genetics can help here. Although so far no one has analyzed DNA from African-American graveyards to chart the emergence of a mixed ancestry community in the United States, genetic studies of the present-day African-American population are already enriching our understanding. Mark Shriver led a 2001 study that analyzed mutations that are extremely different in frequency between present-day Europeans and West Africans in order to study the African-American populations of South Carolina. Shriver and his colleagues used these results to estimate the proportion of ancestors who lived in Europe a few dozen generations earlier. The highest proportion, around 18%, is found in the inland state capital, Columbia, a percentage at the low end of the range of cities in other U.S. states. They estimated about 12% European ancestry along the South Carolina coast, including in the slave port of Charleston, which they thought might reflect waves of slave importation, keeping the African ancestry high. They estimated the lowest proportion of European ancestry, around 4%, on the Sea Islands off the coast, reflecting the history of isolation of the slaves who settled there, an isolation attested to by the fact that the Sea Islanders are the only African Americans still speaking a language, Gullah, with an African-derived grammar. Comparison of Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA types that are highly different in frequency between African Americans and Europeans also shows that by far the majority of the European ancestry in these populations comes from males, the result of social inequality, in which mixed-race couplings were primarily between free males and female slaves. The patterns in South Carolina are a microcosm of those in the United States as a whole. Katarzyna Britz at the personal ancestry testing company 23andMe worked with me to analyze more than 5,000 self-described African Americans in the company database, and found that the average European ancestry proportion was 27% in most of the genome, but only 23% on chromosome X, comparing proportions of ancestry on chromosome X and the other chromosomes, can provide information about differences in male and female behavior during population mixture, because two-thirds of X chromosomes in the world are carried in females, compared to only about half of all other chromosomes. So the X chromosome is relatively more influenced by female history. By computing the proportion of European male and female ancestors that would be necessary to produce the observed difference in European ancestry between chromosome X and the autosomes, Britz was able to estimate the separate male, 38%, and female, 10%, proportion of European ancestors in African Americans. These numbers imply that the contribution of European American men to the genetic makeup of the present-day African American population is about four times that of European American women. When I discussed these findings with the sociologist Orlando Patterson, he pointed out that the fraction of the European ancestry in African Americans that came from males, which, if different from half, is called sex bias, must have been far greater during the time of slavery. Since the civil rights movement in the United States in the mid-20th century, cultural changes have caused the sex bias to reverse, with more coupling between black men and white women. If we carried out DNA studies of African-American skeletons from 100 years ago, there is every reason to expect an even greater sex bias. The genetic pattern suggests that the Thomas Jefferson-Sally Hemings model was replicated countless times by other couples. While this story is one we know about, because it is close to us in time and involved famous people, there is every reason to think that sex bias has been central to the history of our species. The genome revolution makes it possible to measure sex bias dating to periods for which we have no records, and thus to begin to understand how inequality may have shaped humanity in deep time. The genomic signature of inequality. In humans, the profound biological differences that exist between the sexes mean that a single male is physically capable of having far more children than is a single female. Women carry unborn children for 9 months and often nurse them for several years prior to having additional children. Men, meanwhile, are able to procreate while investing far less time in the bearing and early rearing of each child, a biological difference whose effects are amplified by social factors, such as the fact that in many societies, men are expected to spend little time with their children. So it is that, as measured by the contribution to the next generation, powerful men have the potential to have a far greater impact than powerful women. And we can see this in genetic data. The great variability among males in the number of offspring produced means that by searching for genomic signatures of past variability in the number of children men have had, we can obtain genetic insights into the degree of social inequality in society as a whole, and not just between males and females. An extraordinary example of this is provided by the inequality in the number of male offspring that seems to have characterized the empire established by Genghis Khan, who ruled land stretching from China to the Caspian Sea. After his death in 1227, his successors, including several of his sons and grandsons, extended the Mongol Empire even farther, to Korea in the east, to Central Europe in the west, and to Tibet in the south. The Mongols maintained rested horses at strategically spaced posts, allowing rapid communication across their more than 8,000-kilometer span of territory. The United Mongol Empire was short-lived. For example, the Yuan dynasty they established in China fell in 1368. But their rise to power, nevertheless, allowed them to leave an extraordinary genetic impact on Eurasia. A 2003 study led by Christopher Tyler Smith showed how a relatively small number of powerful males living during the Mongol period succeeded in having an outsized impact on the billions of people living in East Eurasia today. His study of Y chromosome suggested that one single male who lived around the time of the Mongols left many millions of direct male line descendants across the territory that the Mongols occupied. The evidence is that about 8% of males in the lands that the Mongol Empire once occupied share a characteristic Y chromosome sequence, or one differing from it by just a few mutations. Tyler Smith and his colleagues called this a star cluster, to reflect the idea of a single ancestor with many descendants, and estimated the date of the founder of this lineage to be 1300 to 700 years ago, based on the estimated rate of accumulation of mutations on the Y chromosome. The date coincides with that of Genghis Khan, suggesting that this single successful Y chromosome may have been his. Star clusters are not limited to Asia. The geneticist Daniel Bradley and his colleagues identified a Y chromosome type that is present in 2 to 3 million people today and derives from an ancestor who lived around 1500 years ago. It is especially common in people with the last name O'Donnell, who descend from one of the most powerful royal families of medieval Ireland, the descendants of Niall, referring to Niall of the Nine Hostages, a legendary warlord from the earliest period of medieval Irish history. If Niall actually existed, he would have lived at about the right time to match the Y chromosome ancestor. Star clusters capture the imagination because they can be tied, albeit speculatively, to historical figures. But the more important point is that star cluster analysis provides insights about shifts in social structure that occurred in the deep past that are difficult to get information about in other ways. This is therefore one area in which Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA analysis can be instructive, even without whole genome data. For example, a perennial debate among historians is the extent to which the human past is shaped by single individuals, whose actions leave a disproportionate impact on subsequent generations. Star cluster analysis provides objective information about the importance of extreme inequalities in power at different points in the past. Two studies, one led by Tomas Kivisild and the other led by Mark Stoneking, have compared the results of star cluster analysis on Y chromosome sequences and on mitochondrial DNA sequences, and arrived at an extraordinary result. By counting the number of differences per DNA letter between pairs of sequences, which reflects mutations that accumulated in a clock-like way over time, these studies estimated the time since different pairs of individuals shared common ancestors on the entirely male Y chromosome and entirely female mitochondrial DNA lineages. In mitochondrial DNA data, all the studies found that most couples living in a population today have a very low probability of sharing a common ancestor along their entirely female line in the last 10,000 years, a period postdating the transition to agriculture in many parts of the world. This is exactly as expected if population sizes were large throughout this period. But on the Y chromosome, the studies found a pattern that was strikingly different. In East Asians, Europeans, Near Easterners, and North Africans, the authors found many star clusters with common male ancestors living roughly around 5,000 years ago. The time around 5,000 years ago coincides with the period in Eurasia that the archaeologist Andrew Sherritt called the Secondary Products Revolution, in which people began to find many uses for domesticated animals beyond meat production, including employing them to pull carts and plows, and to produce dairy products and clothing such as wool. This was also around the time of the onset of the Bronze Age, a period of greatly increased human mobility and wealth accumulation, facilitated by the domestication of the horse, the invention of the wheel and wheeled vehicles, and the accumulation of rare metals like copper and tin, which are the ingredients of bronze and had to be imported from hundreds or even thousands of kilometers away. The Y chromosome patterns reveal that this was also a time of greatly increased inequality, a genetic reflection of the unprecedented concentration of power in tiny fractions of the population that began to be possible during this time due to the new economy. Powerful males in this period left an extraordinary impact on the populations that followed them, more than in any previous period, with some bequeathing DNA to more descendants today than Genghis Khan. From ancient DNA, combined with archaeology, we are beginning to build a picture of what this inequality might have meant. The period around 5,000 years ago, north of the Black and Caspian Seas, corresponds to the rise of the Yamnaya, who, as discussed in Part 2, took advantage of horses and wheels to exploit the resources of the open steppe for the first time. The genetic data show that the Yamnaya and their descendants were extraordinarily successful, largely displacing the farmers of northern Europe in the west and the hunter-gatherers of Central Asia in the east. The archaeologist Maria Gimbutis has argued that Yamnaya society was unprecedentedly sex-biased and stratified. The Yamnaya left behind great mounds, about 80% of which had male skeletons at the center, often with evidence of violent injuries and buried amidst fearsome metal daggers and axes. Gimbutis argued that the arrival of the Yamnaya in Europe heralded a shift in the power relationships between the sexes. It coincided with the decline of Old Europe, which, according to Gimbutis, was a society with little evidence of violence, and in which females played a central social role, as is apparent in the ubiquitous Venus figurines. In her reconstruction, Old Europe was replaced by a male-centered society, evident not only in the archaeology, but also in the male-centered Greek, Norse, and Hindu mythologies of the Indo-European cultures, plausibly spread by the Yamnaya. Any attempt to paint a vivid picture of what a human culture was like before the period of written texts needs to be viewed with caution. Nevertheless, ancient DNA data have provided evidence that the Yamnaya were indeed a society in which power was concentrated among a small number of elite males. The Y chromosomes that the Yamnaya carried were nearly all of a few types, which shows that a limited number of males must have been extraordinarily successful in spreading their genes. In contrast, in their mitochondrial DNA, the Yamnaya had more diverse sequences. The descendants of the Yamnaya or their close relatives spread their Y chromosomes into Europe and India. And the demographic impact of this expansion was profound. As the Y chromosome types they carried were absent in Europe and India before the Bronze Age, but are predominant in both places today. This Yamnaya expansion also cannot have been entirely friendly, as is clear from the fact that the proportion of Y chromosomes of steppe origin in both Western Europe and in India today is much larger than the proportion of steppe ancestry in the rest of the genome. This preponderance of male ancestry coming from the steppe implies that male descendants of the Yamnaya with political or social power were more successful at competing for local mates than men from the local groups. The most striking example I know of is from Iberia in far southwestern Europe, where Yamnaya-derived ancestry arrived at the onset of the Bronze Age, between 4500 and 4000 years ago. Daniel Bradley's laboratory and my laboratory independently produced ancient DNA from individuals of this period. We found that approximately 30% of the Iberian population was replaced along with the arrival of steppe ancestry. However, the replacement of Y chromosomes was much more dramatic. In our data, around 90% of males who carry Yamnaya ancestry have a Y chromosome type of steppe origin that was absent in Iberia prior to that time. It is clear that there were extraordinary hierarchies and imbalances in power at work in the expansions from the steppe. The star cluster work rests on Y chromosomes and mitochondrial DNA. What can whole genome analysis add? When whole genome data are used to reconstruct the size of the ancestral population of most agricultural groups in the last 10,000 years, they document population growth throughout this period, with no evidence of the Bronze Age population bottlenecks detected from Y chromosomes. This is not what one would expect from averaging the mitochondrial DNA and Y chromosomes. Instead, it is clear that the Y chromosome was a non-representative part of the genome, where certain genetic types were more successful at being passed down to later generations than others. In principle, one possible explanation for this is natural selection, whereby some Y chromosomes gave a biological advantage to those who carried them, such as increased fertility. But the fact that this genetic pattern manifested itself around the same time in multiple places around the world, in a period coinciding with the rise of socially stratified societies, is too striking a pattern to be explained by natural selection at multiple, independently occurring, advantageous mutations. I think a more plausible explanation is that in this period, it began to be possible for single males to accumulate so much power that they could not only gain access to large numbers of females, but they could also pass on their social prestige to subsequent generations and ensure that their male descendants were similarly successful. This process caused the Y chromosomes these males carried to increase in frequency, generation after generation, leaving a genetic scar that speaks volumes about past societies. It is also possible that in this period, individual women began to accumulate more power than they ever had before. Yet, because it is biologically impossible for a woman, even a very powerful one, to have an extremely large number of children, the genetic effects of social inequality are much easier to detect on the male line. Sex bias in population mixture. There are many ways that populations come together. For example, through invasions, migrations into each other's homelands, demographic expansion into the same territory, and trade and cultural exchange. Potentially, populations could mix as equals. For example, through the overlapping of two equally resourced populations moving peaceably into the same area. But much more often, there is asymmetry in the relationship, as reflected in mixture involving males from one group and females from the other, as occurred in the history of African Americans and in the history of the Yamnaya. The different histories of men and women recorded in different parts of the genome make it possible to study this mixture, and thereby to obtain clues about cultural interactions that occurred long ago. Some of the examples of sex bias evident from genetic data are truly ancient. Take, for example, the founding of the ancestral population of non-Africans. Any genetic analysis of non-Africans reveals evidence of a population bottleneck, dating to some time before 50,000 years ago. That is, a small number of individuals giving rise to many descendants today.